very standard issue. Yeah. Oh, don't know. Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the last afternoon of our conference on bicameralism. And this afternoon, our thoughts are turning to Canada. And for Australians, Canada has a lot of mystery and enticement. You know, there are a lot of similarities between us on a superficial level. We both have a huge country with a relatively sparse population. We've got concentrations of population on the eastern side, and then this rebel rabble on the west who thinks they can do things their own way. And superficially, we have similar political systems. We look to Britain, both of us, for our forebears. But I think the Canadians have done things rather differently than we have. And this afternoon, to tell us about or give us Canadian perspectives, we have a Canadian and an Aussie who lives in Canada. But first of all, Professor Janet Hebert is teaching currently at the Department of Political Studies at Queen's University, and she's going to take the floor first. Her interests include this very interesting Charter of Rights and its impact on legislative and other activities at that level. And then secondly, Professor Campbell Sharman, who's currently based at UBC, University of British Columbia, but is very well known to us in Australia, and particularly for his fabulous database. But let me first invite Janet Hebert to address you. Thank you very much, Janet.
Thank you. I want to thank John Ewer for the invitation to come here. I'm actually going to look beyond Canada and look at a couple other jurisdictions as well. My paper addresses a significant constitutional or quasi-constitutional change to both bicameral and one unicameral systems, two unicameral systems, that has arisen as largely a result of skepticism over Parliament's capacity to check government. And I'll begin with the recollection of a spirited conversation I had more than a decade ago. I think it was my first trip to Australia, and it was with Campbell Sharman. Now, I was giving some talk at Perth on the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and how it had impacted on government. And in response to my thesis, Campbell replied, "Well, maybe Canada needs a charter, but Australia doesn't. We have the Senate." Well, after probing, his assumptions became clear. A well-functioning parliament, which presumes bicameralism, I'm assuming, reduces, if not eliminates, the need for a Bill of Rights. And by implication, if Canada needed a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, this was an indictment, an indictment of the health of our parliamentary system rather than any acknowledgement of any inherent virtue in a Bill of Rights. And Campbell's certainly in good company in this belief that a properly functioning parliamentary system does not require a Bill of Rights. Moreover, for the longest time, many have argued that a Westminster-based parliamentary system is logically incompatible with a Bill of Rights, or at least one subject to judicial review. And these two premises are related by the following assumption: rights are protected by, not from, Parliament. And many would add the caveat of bicameralism to ensure an effective parliamentary check on the government. Well, as tempted as I am to sort of take on this debate, I want to ask a different question and, in a sense, reverse the focus. Instead of asking if a well-functioning parliamentary system reduces the need for a Bill of Rights, I want to ask the following two questions. What impact does a Bill of Rights have on Parliament? And does bicameralism affect how Parliament responds to a Bill of Rights? My discussion will consider several parliamentary jurisdictions that have adopted Bills of Rights, and I'll begin with Canada, which introduced a statutory Bill of Rights in 1960. Now, this was a really weak and ineffective Bill of Rights that doesn't warrant much attention, apart from one important innovation. And this was a new statutory requirement that the Minister of Justice alert the House of Commons if a government bill is inconsistent with rights. Now, the assumption was that this reporting requirement would trigger pre-legislative review, thus making the bureaucracy, the government, and Parliament more aware of how legislation implicates rights so as to avoid violating rights unknowingly. Moreover, in the event that government decided to proceed with a bill that violates rights, it could be expected to have to defend this legislation in vigorous debate in Parliament. The intent was quite radical. Apart from the objective of changing policy processes and political debates, the intent was to actually alter how conventional wisdom portrays bills of rights as functioning. Instead of relying on courts to provide remedies for rights abuses that have already occurred, the hope was that this new process of reporting on bills would help prevent rights abuses from actually occurring. Well, this all sounds very noble, if not overly ambitious. But the idea of creating incentives and procedures for pre- and post-legislative review has had remarkable traction. In 1982, Canada adopted the Charter of Rights, which is a constitutional bill of rights that gives courts the power to declare legislation invalid if inconsistent with rights. And even with this more forceful bill of rights, Canada has retained this statutory reporting requirement. Now, in 1990, New Zealand adopted a weak bill of rights, one that does not give courts the authority to declare that legislation is inconsistent with rights or to grant remedies such as invalidation of legislation. Then Prime Minister Geoffrey Palmer had hoped for a stronger Bill of Rights, but unable to sell his own party on this, he proposed a similar reporting requirement as Canada had in the hope of making his Bill of Rights more potent. Section 7 of the New Zealand Bill of Rights requires the Attorney General advise Parliament when bills are not consistent with its provisions. In 1998, the United Kingdom introduced the Human Rights Act, which incorporates the European Convention of Human Rights into domestic law. It also has a reporting requirement. Now, in the UK, judges have more power than in New Zealand and less power than in Canada. Courts cannot suspend or invalidate legislation, but they can declare that it's incompatible with rights. While the UK has also introduced this ministerial reporting requirement for compatibility, but it differs from both the New Zealand and the Canadian variations. First, the report must indicate either compatibility or an inability to claim compatibility. Second, the responsibility is broadly dispersed with all ministers rather than being located singularly either with the Justice Minister or the Attorney General. Third, the requirement has a bicameral dimension. A report must be made to each House. Thus, if one House makes amendments to a bill that compromises the compatibility status, the government must introduce a bill in the other House, or a notice in the other House. Fourth, the idea of reporting to Parliament is supported by the creation of a joint committee, which examines bills that have implications for rights and also focuses on the explanations ministers give in terms of claiming compatibility. Well, Australia, new to the world of bills of rights, you have two, and you may have another one because the Commonwealth government is pledging several millions of dollars to have a consultation committee. While the ACT 2004 Human Rights Act also has a reporting mechanism requiring the Attorney General make a statement that a bill is consistent or a declaration that a statement of consistency can't be made. And the 2006 Victoria Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities also includes a reporting requirement which adds another dimension. It obliges any member of Parliament who introduces a bill to present a compatibility statement before whichever House the bill is introduced. So again, sort of a bicameral dimension potentially for this. The Victoria Act also authorizes a parliamentary committee, the Scrutiny of Acts and Regulations Committee, to consider any bill and to report on whether or not bills are compatible with rights. So all of these jurisdictions have defended these requirements as strengthening Parliament's capacity to hold government to account on matters of rights. So how do these bills of rights with their reporting requirements affect Parliament? Well, before pursuing this question, I think it's really important to recognize a paradox of sorts in how Parliament's rights-protecting role is being portrayed. On the one hand, it's Parliament's very weakness relative to the government that is said to be an important reason why a Bill of Rights is necessary in the first place. And you'll find this fairly extensively in the literature and in consultation documents with public when they're asked to express views on this issue. But on the other hand, Parliament is expected to pressure the government and is being portrayed as playing an important role in scrutinizing bills from a rights perspective. Yet, apart from this reporting requirement, no substantive reforms have been passed in any of these jurisdictions that would seriously alter the balance of power between Parliament and the executive. So what can be said of Parliament's scrutiny role on questions involving rights, and what difference does bicameralism make? So let me begin with Canada. While all proposed legislation is subject to fairly rigorous bureaucratic scrutiny, in fact, a legislative initiative cannot proceed to cabinet unless there's been a legal legal-based assessment of the prospects of charter litigation. But this hasn't improved Parliament's power. If anything, Parliament seems weaker than before, and there's a three-part explanation for this. First, government in Canada is keenly aware of the consequences of losing a charter case. Remember, courts in Canada can invalidate legislation, and they have on many occasions. Well, regardless of which political party is in power, governments are concerned about the costs of defending legislation and by the practical and political consequences of having their legislative priorities derailed by judicial review. As a result, Canadian governments rely heavily on government lawyers who utilize case law and make risk-based assessments of the likelihood that legislation will be litigated or litigated unsuccessfully from the government's perspective. As a result, the government will make amendments to a bill to try and minimize this possibility. But these amendments come before the bill is introduced to Parliament, and Parliament is considered completely peripheral to this whole exercise. From the government's perspective, it's to courts they must justify their decisions, not Parliament. Second, no Canadian government is willing to ever report to Parliament that a bill is not consistent with the Charter. No report of incompatibility has ever been made, and I'm feeling fairly confident suggesting no report will ever be made, no matter which party is in power. Now, it's pretty easy to understand why a government would not willingly acknowledge to Parliament that a bill is inconsistent with the Charter. This admission would make the legislation extremely vulnerable to judicial invalidation if it was subject to litigation. How could a government reasonably defend the legislation in court if the Justice Minister has already stood up in Parliament and stated that the legislation is inconsistent with the Charter? Well, because of these implications, bills will be amended so as to satisfy the Minister of Justice that it's consistent with the Charter. In Canada, the test is there a credible Charter justification? Now, I'll leave aside the obvious issue of whether there's reason to be confident in the Minister's judgment or whether political considerations affect principal judgment. But a consequence of its refusal to ever report to Parliament is the steady erosion of the expectation that government is required to justify its assumptions about the Charter in Parliament. Third, the Canadian House of Commons lacks the will and sense of competence to engage in judgments about Charter compatibility. Now, this doesn't mean Canada lacks committees that could consider these issues. Each House of Parliament has a specific committee that does examine legal and constitutional matters. But the relevant Commons Committee suffers the problems of all Canadian House of Commons committees. Its work is heavily influenced by government dominance, strong party discipline, and a parliamentary culture that places little importance on the role of parliamentary committees. But it's not simply a matter of power. The explanation is more complicated. The Charter has resulted in a highly legalized form of policy and political debate. Judicial rulings have become the proxy for political decisions about compatibility. And the consequence is that parliamentarians assume they have little role to play in contributing to judgments about Charter compatibility. Now, Canada is a bicameral system, but the Senate is much, much, much weaker than in Australia. Not formally in terms of its powers, but politically in terms of in what it's willing to do. Well, although senators have more liberty from partisan pressures than their House of Commons counterparts, and in fact are more likely to ask questions about Charter compatibility than their Commons colleagues, the Senate's serious legitimacy problems due to the unelected status of the Senate and the entrenched practice of partisan appointments constrains the Senate's willingness to exercise its powers. So what about these other jurisdictions? Well, New Zealand's a unicameral system, and while parliamentary committees there have more influence than in Canada, this almost certainly has more to do with the electoral system, MMP, than it does with a rights culture. Bills are rarely evaluated in Parliament in terms of their implications for rights. In a sense, this is ironic, because New Zealand does not suffer the same obstacle that all the other parliamentary jurisdictions face on this matter, and that is knowing something about the government's assumptions about compatibility. Why? The government in the UK actually publishes its legal advice on the web. In Canada and the UK, this is treated as highly confidential and not to be seen by anyone else. Well, in the UK, let me turn to the UK. The political system, obviously, is highly partisan, as it is in Canada. but it has a far more effective committee system, at least in terms of evaluating matters pertaining to rights. The relevant committee here is a joint committee. It's the Joint Committee on Human Rights, which has been particularly impressive as measured by a willingness to ask tough questions about bills that implicate rights, operate in a manner generally free of partisan divisions, and provide thorough and timely reports to Parliament. So why is this committee more capable of engaging in robust rights scrutiny than parliamentary committees in Canada or New Zealand? Well, I think there's a three-part explanation. First, the size of the UK legislature. The UK House of Commons is considerably larger than its New Zealand or Canadian counterparts, meaning there are far more parliamentarians who must accept that they cannot reasonably aspire to the front benches as a result are more likely to understand their role as parliamentarians. Now, I'll never forget a conversation I had many years ago with Barney Cooney, who, as you know, served as a chair of the Australian Commonwealth Scrutiny of Bills Committee. Now, although he was a senator, I think his comments also are apt for the House, for any lower house. So when I asked him, "Are you ever worried that your scrutiny role will get you in trouble with your party?" He said, "Look, I'm not going anywhere. I'm a parliamentarian. Granted, I'm a better parliamentarian when we're in opposition, but, you know, still, that's my role." Second reason, the JCHR is jointly constituted. It's got 6 members from each house. And unlike Canada's Senate, which is unwilling to check government very often because of its low level of legitimacy, as we hear, the House of Lords doesn't seem to have as much reticence, and its confidence is growing. Moreover, the JCHR is not dominated numerically by members of the government party. Third, the JCHR takes its role extremely seriously. It calls itself the Parliamentary Guardians of the Human Rights Act, and unlike the Canadian Committee, does not treat questions of compatibility as the exclusive prerogative of courts. Now, this doesn't mean the JCHR hasn't had growing pains. In 2006, it altered its approach in light of an internal debate over the following issues: that its review comes too late in the process to have any practical consequences for a bill, that its heavy focus on the legal dimension of compatibility means it's easy to have its views discounted in a war of competing legal opinions, and that its heavy emphasis on scrutinizing all government bills leaves it too little time to do things that might be more effective, such as commenting on earlier on draft bills, draft papers, before the government's position has crystallized, when it's more amenable to change. So can we assume that the JCHR improves Parliament's rights-protecting role? And how do we judge effectiveness? Well, one measure might be its ability to facilitate rigorous parliamentary debate. Well, not a lot of indication, at least in the House of Commons. The House of Commons is far less likely to consider rights, although rights simply certainly do come up, and that was particularly clear in anti-terrorist debates. But a lot of members of the House of Commons don't even know about the JCHR, and often, you know, rarely refer to its reports. Now, the Lords is a different matter. Rights-based objections are frequently made, along with regular references to the JCHR. But it's not clear if these JCHR references are simply to reinforce positions already taken or inform those positions. Perhaps a more clear measure of effectiveness is whether the JCHR or parliamentary debate influences legislation. The government rarely amends a bill solely on the basis of a JCHR report. It tends to do so only if rights-based arguments are being marshaled as reasons for opposing a bill, which seems to be more likely to occur in the House of Lords than in the House of Commons. I've interviewed senior public and political officials, and they indicate that by the time a JCHR report has been made, the government is unlikely to accept the case for amendment. By this stage, it will have gone through its own complex pre-legislative review process, elicited several legal opinions, maybe even asked the Attorney General to weigh in on the issue. Moreover, unlike Canada, where the Charter is hugely popular and there's a strong culture of deference to the courts, these conditions are not as strong in the UK. Although governments generally try to avoid a negative judicial ruling, largely because concerns that if Strasbourg rules against the government, it will be treaty-bound to accept the decision, the UK government doesn't have the immediate fear of having legislation invalidated. Moreover, because the Human Rights Act is not as popular, it's not very popular at all, being inconsistent with the courts doesn't have the same political consequences as in Canada. So I want to return to the question of whether a Bill of Rights, in combination with a sort of compatibility reporting requirement, can accomplish 2 ambitious and related goals: improving a government's commitment to protect rights by providing incentives and structure for parliamentary rights-based review that checks the government. Well, however laudable the objective, the more my research progresses, I'm becoming increasingly skeptical about whether these related goals are attainable. But before foreclosing on the idea, I want to suggest two conditions that are essential, but not necessarily sufficient to achieve this. First, there must be sufficient costs for government to fail to comply with rights. Now, these costs can be either legal or political. Legal costs are more substantial in Canada, where courts can invalidate legislation. But they can also be significant in the UK. Again, if Strasbourg rules against the government, it will be treaty-bound to accept the decision. Other jurisdictions also confront those softer forms of legal costs. Where judicial power is more constrained, courts could still interpret rights in a way that changes the scope or effects of legislation. And if a government wished to reverse this effect, it would have to pass new legislation to overturn the court's decision and therefore count or potentially have criticism that it's violating rights. So what about political costs? Is Parliament willing to cause government significant difficulty about legislation that's inconsistent with rights? And does the public criticize government for appearing to be inconsistent with rights? Well, here bicameralism is certainly relevant, particularly where the government doesn't dominate both houses, because, I mean, how can Parliament check the government if, in fact, government controls both houses? We see this most clearly in the UK, where the House of Lords has caused the government considerable grief, particularly about anti-terrorist measures and 400 defeats, as Meg told us. Not all because they're inconsistent with rights, but the House of Lords is pretty robust in its scrutinizing of legislation from a rights perspective. And even in Canada, where our Senate is perceived to be weak, it has caused the government to revise legislative initiatives because of their apparent inconsistency with rights, again, our anti-terrorist measures. But is bicameralism sufficient to ensure that government complies with rights? Probably not. My research suggests that legal costs are more effective than political costs in ensuring that government takes the Bill of Rights seriously in terms of constraining or altering its decisions. And if I'm correct, there's a bit of an irony here with respect to the idealism in this reporting requirement, again, that it was going to strengthen Parliament's capacity to hold the government to account. Why? Why is there an irony here? Well, higher costs are more likely to make the government sensitive to rights, but not necessarily in a way that involves Parliament. Where legal costs are high, governments look to courts, not Parliament, and Parliament's considered quite peripheral to the whole exercise. And in Canada, Parliament perceives itself as being quite peripheral to judgments about rights. These are for law. These are for constitutional lawyers, they think. Well, what's the second condition? Well, the second condition is a Bill of Rights must not dissuade Parliament for assuming that it has a legitimate role to play in contributing to judgments about compatibility. The ability of Parliament to pressure government or to explain or to amend legislation where rights are implicated is not only affected by bicameralism, but also by how Parliament conceives of its role in terms of protecting rights. Now, in Canada, the House of Commons is marginalized not only because of party discipline and government dominance, and at the bicameral level because of a weak Senate, but by the dominance of a legal compliant culture that treats charter issues as a prerogative of courts, not of legislatures. In the UK, the culture of compliance and political deference to judicial decisions are less pronounced, which has meant more opportunity for Parliament to form its own judgment about the merits of legislation. And bicameralism certainly reinforces the role of Parliament to check the government on questions about rights. As I suggested earlier, the House of Lords is far more likely to raise questions of compatibility and pressure government for amendments. The government will consider amendments to address concerns in the House of Lords if it fears delay or defeat of its legislation. Well, in New Zealand, the Bill of Rights Act has very little impact on Parliament. The unicameral Parliament has a reputation for being one of the fastest legislatures going in terms of passing legislation, and this isn't conducive for parliamentary scrutiny, at least on questions of rights. I had an interesting interview with the clerk of the House when I asked him, given that you have compatibility requirements at the start of legislation, and the New Zealand legislative process is a little bit of a sausage factory, and it looks a lot different coming out than it went going in, should you have a rights compatibility process at the end? And he says, well, actually, I prefer parliamentary sovereignty to bills of rights, but I wouldn't mind that to slow down the process. So, you know, from a functional perspective, he would have liked to have some mechanism to slow down the legislative process, even if it had to be a focus on rights, which he didn't necessarily think was useful. I hesitate to suggest one more condition because the jury's still out on whether and how it makes a difference. But if Parliament is going to conceive of its role as a guardian of rights and a check on government power, it will need assistance and guidance, and this is most likely to come from a specialized committee. Moreover, the ability of this committee to act in a way that would check the government is going to be stronger if there's bicameralism, if it's a jointly constituted committee. Well, Canada, we don't have any such body. New Zealand, obviously, it's a unicameral system. Plus, they don't have a rights committee in the House of Reps. The UK, well, clearly, I think the Joint Committee has made a vast improvement in terms of Parliament's capacity to engage the government. Still, doesn't seem to be sufficient, though. Again, the government doesn't do any more than it has to in terms of addressing these rights concerns. If, you know, it's got its legal opinion, it will go with that. Let me just speculate before I conclude on the new Australian jurisdictions with bills of rights. For the ACT, I really worry the tiny size of a unicameral legislature is going to make scrutiny of bills pretty tough. I mean, we're talking 3 members on the committee. Victoria, I haven't had an opportunity to study this new system of electing members to the upper house, but based on yesterday's conversation, I'm not overly optimistic. Now, Victoria does have some experience with rights-based scrutiny. It precedes its charter. In the past, though, partisan divisions were really hard to overcome. The way the committee tried to do this was separate the question from whether a right has been infringed from whether the infringement was undue. But this really kind of avoids the big question. So let me wrap up here. The capacity of a Bill of Rights to involve Parliament in a scrutiny function and in a rights-protecting function, rather to rely exclusively on courts, which is the way we normally think of bills of rights, will depend heavily on whether a rights culture emerges and in form that doesn't undermine an institutional willingness or capacity to consider rights, not as simply legal ideas, but as issues for Parliament to engage. This is more likely to occur where there is effective bicameralism, as distinct from the Canadian situation. But where a Bill of Rights imposes significant legal costs for pursuing legislation that's inconsistent with rights, it's quite probable that governments will look to the courts, not to Parliament, as the principal institution for justifying its decision. In other words, case law, rather than parliamentary judgment, will become the more likely basis for shaping government decisions about whether or not their actions are consistent with the Bill of Rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet, and thank you also for keeping to such perfect timing. Campbell, the benchmark is set, and I'd invite you to address us.
The presentation is red. Actually, goes with the carpet too, doesn't it? But for the chamber, First, a disclaimer. I'm not an expert on the Canadian Senate, but for the last year or two, I've been reading a lot about the structure of the Senate and proposals for reform. I was just thinking, if someone was asking me how often the Canadian Senate knocked back bills, I couldn't answer you. But okay. I want to deal with 3 things. I want to give you some background for what is a rather unusual institution. I want to look at the debate over reform, which has been going on basically since 1867, and I want to look at the actions of the current Harper government, which are interesting. They're really unusually interesting. Okay, let's see if this works. Oh, it does, good. Okay, unlike Australia, Canada does not have a tradition of strong parliamentary bicameralism. And to a certain extent, we've dealt with this before. Upper House is not part of the colonial experience, really. And the reason I give there is that when Canada was federating in the 1860s leading up to Confederation in 1867, responsible government itself was still new. And moreover, legislative councils had a bad reputation in Canada because they had been used in some Canadian colonies by the Crown to try and restrain popular involvement in government. So the founders were very apprehensive about upper houses. Now, in Confederation itself, there was a broad agreement that the powerful upper house was not a bad idea. The quote, "a sober second thought," is one from John A. Macdonald, who was the founder and the first Prime Minister of Canada, and this is often used, you know, the chamber of sober second thought. But the reason why it was thought you couldn't have an elected one, okay, as every Canadian, every Australian government since 18, well, every, certainly every Australian government recently would say it threatens the accountability of a popularly elected lower house. We've dealt with this elsewhere. Being elected, the Senate would be subverted by partisan interests rather than representing sectional and, above all, the regional interests of political communities in Canada. And the result was a powerful second chamber of fixed size. I want to stress the fixed size, based on regional representation, whose members were appointed by the executive and whose structure is constitutionally entrenched and has been so in various ways since 1867. Now, originally it was 72 members, now it's 105, and region is paramount now as it was in 1867. And you can see that it's divided into four divisions: Ontario, Quebec, Maritimes provinces, and Western provinces. And there are 24 in each of those divisions, broken up Maritimes and Western provinces into subsets: New Brunswick 10, Nova Scotia 10, PEI 4, BC, British Columbia 6, Alberta 6, Saskatchewan 6, and Manitoba 6. And then Newfoundland and Labrador, as a latecomer in 1949, got another 6, and the three territories, Yukon, Northwest Territories, and Nunavut, which joined and became an autonomous territory in 1999, have got 1, and that adds up to 105. Now, I don't know whether you can see the numbers, but that just gives you an idea of population and the distribution. But the main point is that there are winners. Sometimes this works. Okay, so that last column is the ratio of advantage. So Prince Edward Island has close to 9 times the representation in the Senate that its population would suggest. New Brunswick is a winner. All the territories are winners, and Nunavut, of course, in particular. And as there are winners, there are also losers. So Ontario, the biggest province, is a loser. Alberta, the newly growing West, Alberta and British Columbia, are also losers. But the main point is that party dominates, or region is trumped by party. The Prime Minister nominates senators, and they're appointed by the Governor-General, but nominated by the Prime Minister, and they're there for life, all right, since 1965, it's until they retire, but basically it's a almost unlimited term. And so you're appointed largely, almost exclusively, on your loyalty to the National Party. And the only limit on the Prime Minister's discretion is the rate at which senators can be replaced. That's retirement or death must take their toll, and the location of the vacancy, because that regional constraints are very severe. You can only appoint someone from a province, so a vacancy occurred in that provincial or in that divisional area. And in Quebec, it's even more limited because there are divisions within Quebec that have to be represented. And, of course, this means long-standing governments create a one-party-dominated Senate, and after 13 years of Liberal government, the Harper Conservative government, when it came in 2006, was faced with 62 Liberal senators out of a chamber of 105. I don't know if they fly on different planes to make sure that there was a plane crash, but you'd have to lose quite a few. And, of course, they're going different directions because they live in different provinces. Now, the partisan nature of the Senate and the method of appointment undermine the legitimacy. We'll go through this quickly because you're all familiar with it. If it's the same party, it doesn't do much. If it's the opposite party, it's driven in Canada by the tactical considerations of the lower house opposition, of the major lower house opposition party. So, and critically, There are severe limits on the extensive powers of the Senate to challenge the lower house because of the appointed nature of the membership. If the Senate says, we don't approve of this, the government says, who are you? You know, you're just an appointed lot. Mulroney, either has-beens or never worse. Okay. This has not stopped the Senate from occasionally embarrassing the government. And the best case, or the most famous recent case, is the Mulroney government didn't have a majority in the upper house. It wanted to pass a federal sales tax, which, as you can imagine, was not very popular. Didn't have the fortitude of Mr. Howard to go to an election saying, I promise you a new tax. Mr. Mulroney decided he would slip it in after he'd been elected. He used a section of the Constitution which had never been used before and got an additional two senators from each of the divisions, and he picked them as Conservatives, and with the odd independent, he managed to get his bill passed. So on occasion, the Senate has proved pretty stroppy, there it was overridden. In some ways, I think it actually proved action by Mulroney actually enhanced the legitimacy of the Senate, because if he'd really wanted to fight, he could have called a general election and then got endorsement for that. But on the other hand, he just introduced a new tax, so that was the last thing he wanted to do. Okay, so whatever its partisan composition, the Senate carries out a range of useful tasks. I mean, the people who are expert about the activity of the Senate say it's a good thing. It does useful things. It has good committee inquiries. It can look at things with less rush. It's less partisan, generally speaking. But they're ignored by the public. Now I'm going the wrong way. No, it should be noted, actually, my skillful use of the fade does not appear to be driven by this machine. Let's just see if that does work. No. They're supposed to fade in brilliantly, but okay. But anyway, there are two things which I think are very important. Canadians find it hard to conceive of a Senate acting autonomously and able to challenge the government by use of legislative veto. It's just not Canadian. It's a great pause. You know, how can that be? The government was elected. It's got popular endorsement. And as you'll see from my other comments, I believe that in a perverse way, in order for the Senate to have survived this long, it needed to be debauched. And the way of doing it was to have prime ministerial appointments and make it very partisan, so it doesn't have any legitimacy, even though it has powers almost exactly the same as the Australian Senate. Okay. Okay, reform of the Senate has been perennial. Actually, I'm tempted to use this mouse. I spent a lot of time putting the fade in. Let's just see if it... Okay, I'll do the next one. Okay, and the three obvious pressures for reform, regional house, and Senate, an expert Senate, or one which is a more effective check on the executive. Now, that is a fairly recent one. No. I know what happened. It got destroyed in the stick, the USB. Okay. Each of these concerns has generated reform proposals. Bundesrat, or direct elections by province, an expert Senate with reduced powers appointed by whatever, a Senate, a House of Review, gaining its legitimacy from elections, or some other modified proposal. So there have been many of such proposals. But once you list those three, you can't have a chamber that does more than one of them very effectively. So there are major problems. And the thing that tends to be neglected, or the thing that you have to remember if you're reforming a Senate, is party will be critical, constitutional change has proved exceedingly difficult and very divisive, and the most important actor is the Prime Minister, who's got to be persuaded that losing this power to delegitimate another chamber is worth giving up. Okay, so here we have Senate reform as stratagem. And this is the interesting part, I think. Harper government, or elected in 2006, had Senate reform as one of its policy goals soon after it was elected. And some background about Mr. Harper. He comes from the West, and the Western provinces have seen Senate reform as one way of bringing their concerns to the attention of the national government. And the Tripoli Senate was a Western concept. That is, Tripoli, elected, affected, equal, or some combination of those three. Elected, effective in the sense it had real powers, equal in that the provinces had equal representation. But the more interesting thing, perhaps, than groups in, particularly in Alberta, who argued for this Tripoli Senate, was the attempts for a province on its own to elect a senator. And the Alberta government ran Senate nominee elections on its own bat, no prompting from Ottawa. And so it elected these people, ran a provincial Senate election, and said to the Prime Minister, look, next time there's a vacancy, here's your person, because elected. And that's done that three times. Conservative Prime Ministers have obliged. Mr. Mulroney did, in fact, appoint an Alberta senator in that way in 1990. And Mr. Harper has in 2006. The Liberal ones in between, of course, did not. They just laughed and went on their way. Now, Mr. Harper is a Westerner. He leader of the Alliance Party in 2002, chosen of the new Conservative Party. His support base, particularly for his leadership attempts, came from the West. He is interested in Senate reform. And in 2006 and 2007, introduced legislation which was before Parliament before 2008. I should say there's an election for the for Canada in
Tuesday,
on the 14th, both of which these bills have been delayed or defeated. And those two bills are an Act to Amend the Constitution Act, Senate Tenure, and the Senate Appointment Consultations Act. Aha.
Oh. Is that not what you wanted? That's not
right. They weren't flying in. They were fading. I wonder if I've got the right version. Okay. So there's Bill C-19. I'm worried if it is an older version, but that's... Anyway, okay. That's pretty clear. 8-year terms instead of life. And this one, which is the Senate Appointment Consultations Act, with the Prime Minister, so that the Prime Minister would recommend candidates who had won electoral contests in each of the provincial jurisdictions for which there were vacancies. So in other words, what the legislation says is you've got to have a system like Alberta's. And what's more, it says when you have the election, it should be by STV. And it has actually all kinds of other interesting things which prevent parties from running candidates. But that's another story. So the point is that this is an attempt to generate provincial elections for a national body. But, of course... and if you look at the document that comes with explaining what the Act is about, it's, I quote, in future years it may be that an informal practice of appointing senators from a list selected by, of selected nominees will transform itself into a constitutional convention that would, and these inverted commas is in the original, I didn't add it, would constrain the Prime Minister in making his or her choice for Senate appointments. So the, you know, it really does look like it really does look as though this is a way to generate an elected Senate. And Mr. Harper has refused to make any Senate appointments since his coming to office, with the exception of an elected senator from Alberta and a senator from Quebec, who he appointed in the good old-fashioned way because he needed someone to represent Montreal in the cabinet. Okay, so by mid-2008, there were 14 Senate vacancies. And the governments of Manitoba and Saskatchewan had expressed interest in citizen consultation. So he has, again, not surprisingly, Western provinces have said, okay, well, we're interested in the idea. Note they're not liberal there, other than liberal. Okay. Now, is this a cunning plan to ensure an elected Senate by stealth without the need for constitutional amendment? But, and the obvious drawbacks, the plan may require Mr. Huff to be in office for a long time, which I'm sure he'd like. Other Prime Minister's different plans. There's no elections are not mandatory, their results are advisory, there's no requirement for the Prime Minister to consult, and there's little indication that Harper welcomes parliamentary scrutiny. I mean, he runs a minority government, but has nonetheless used whatever powers he can to, perhaps brutally is a little strong, but certainly he doesn't like anyone disagreeing with him or slowing down what he wants to do. So it's not as though he looks the kind of guy who's going to be welcome at Senate scrutiny. Okay. But the Senate, this is why it's a cunning plan, because opposition by the Liberals to the legislation challenges their commitment to democracy. I mean, this is being like against motherhood was. I mean, it's a bad, it's a democracy is a good thing. So what are you doing against it? Hostility further undermines the legitimacy of the Senate in opposing other government legislation. In sum, the short-term payoff is weakening one of the strongest weapons of the opposition Liberal Party. Means that their opposition to the Senate is delegitimated. If so, the plan only works if the Liberals oppose it and the legislation fails. So I've said to people, if I were advising the Liberal Party, I would have said, for God's sake, say yes, and Mr. Harper would be seriously embarrassed because that's not what he wants it to fail. So with failure, Mr. Harper retains the opportunity to stack the Senate, although it's probably unlikely. Okay, the future. Possible futures. Well, there's a plan like Harper's. Other modifications of the appointment procedures to ensure a Senate with a long-term balanced partisan composition. Well, I mean, it's possible, but it's difficult to see it coming by itself. Broad agreement among national and provincial parties that the Senate powers should be reduced, but that requires constitutional amendment. The Senate itself reaches some bipartisan agreement on a package of reforms. That's never really happened. And critically, a Prime Minister who is willing to submit to Senate scrutiny and surrender the power of creating a poison pill for his or her successors. I mean, you don't only get benefits from being in there a long time, but you do nasty things to your successors because it's going to take many deaths before you can unstack the Senate. Okay. Now, you see, this was the old version. There's another sheet. All right. There was another slide which said three important things. One of which I remember. One of them was that, I remember two of them actually. One of them was that there is a massive inconsistency, really, between a majoritarian party-based system and bicameralism. I mean, there is a I'm not saying it can't be overcome, but if you have a system which has a strongly majoritarian view of politics, then bicameralism in current terms is difficult to conceive of. So what you're doing is you're trying to move against the grade. I was very surprised with Tony's figures saying that new legislatures was likely to have bicameralism as old ones, because I would have thought that new ones would be less likely to. Anyway, that's point number one. Point number two, well, this was the third point. The second one I can't remember. This the third one. The last one was that really institutional reform on the scale required for the Canadian Senate requires demonstrable system failure. You need to have something seriously go wrong. And the only thing I could think of that would occur in Canada to generate this would be a government with a large partisan majority in the lower house, the House of Commons, which proceeded to do things which the population seriously disliked and perfectly compatible with the charter, so no charter challenges. But people said, well, we have to change this. And enough popular support for the major opposition party and maybe even some members of the governing party to believe that reforming the Senate was worthwhile and that they could possibly persuade enough of the provinces required for constitutional change to do it. But other than that, you're likely to be stuck with it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Campbell. May I ask the first question out of my ignorance and just ascertain what is the process for changing the Canadian constitution? What are the thresholds?
I was afraid you could ask me that. Oh, it's a formula, something.
Well, there's several formulas. Yeah. I think for the Senate, it's unanimous provincial consent. In other words, you're not going to ever have an equal Senate in Canada because Ontario and Quebec will never support it. Flat out. Period.
And how is that consent ascertained? I mean, I remember Meech Lake and the failure of Meech Lake. What was that all about?
It's still at the provincial... I mean, it's, some provinces might have legislative hearings. There is a convention in Canada. We probably will have a referendum. So you would have to have a majority in each jurisdiction, plus nationally. Hmm.
Okay.
BC, British Columbia, has no referendum for changing its own constitution, but to change for the province to pass legislation to agree to a change in the national constitution, a referendum is required.
Okay, well, we have plenty of time for questions before afternoon tea, so I'd invite anyone who has a question to come to the microphone, identify yourself, and fire away.
Yeah,
750. Okay. Meg, you have a question.
Yeah. I'm interested in asking, I think this came up a little bit yesterday, and it's certainly pertinent with respect to the House of Lords, how the Senate, or to what extent the Senate, uses public opinion to enhance its powers. I think this is something that the House of Lords has done very nicely in recent years, but also in the past. The old House of Lords was aware that it could challenge the government on issues where the government was out of step with public opinion. And there, potentially even an illegitimate house can become legitimate if its arguments are legitimate, as it were. Based on what I said, a kind of obvious point is you say the chamber can be dismissed for being illegitimate because it's appointed. Are you sure? Because we used to think that the House of Lords was illegitimate because it was appointed, but it kind of turns out that it was illegitimate because it was conservative, because it's still appointed, and yet now it has enhanced legitimacy. And a final point, again based on British experience, that Mr. Harper's got to be very careful, because if he delays introducing his legislation, his arguments that the chamber is illegitimate will themselves be seen to be illegitimate. This happened to Tony Blair, that he pointed the finger at the House of Lords and said, "How dare you stand in my way? You're not elected." This worked for 2 or 3 years, but then eventually they started saying, "Well, hang on a minute, you're the government. Where's the bill to elect us? It's not our fault we're not elected. We're just doing our jobs until you reform."
Actually, I can answer those. The first one, the Mulroney episode is interesting. The Conservative Mulroney government did not have a majority in the Senate. And from what I've read, that for a while, the Liberal majority in the Senate did try to make some cheap shots. But they were basically partisan ones. And it was not looked on favorably by the press. So I think you're right. I think there is a time when people realise they're doing their party harm if they're simply exploiting something for partisan gain and no net benefit. But the GST, exactly, that's why they made such a fuss. They knew that Mulroney was already vulnerable. They knew it was a very unpopular move. So they pushed him really hard. And the only way he could get it through was by using this otherwise never before used section to appoint an additional 8 senators. So I think you're right. The thing about the appointment, if I wanted to imply that it was appointed by itself, because, as you know, I've got some stake in saying that it is possible to have a legitimate appointed Senate, but the combination of prime ministerial appointments and strongly partisan ones is deadly. And that is the loss of... So I agree with what you've said about the House of Lords and elsewhere, that if you don't have some... a rough partisan balance, something to make people think that this isn't just party gain, then you're, as my wife would say, hoot. This is Canadian for not good. The last thing is Harper. Maybe I didn't make it clear. I went too quickly. Harper has introduced legislation. He's introduced legislation to shorten terms and to encourage these consultations. The legislation has been rejected and or delayed by the Liberal opposition saying, well, of course, this raises a constitutional question. This is back to Harry's point. If in doubt, say it raises a constitutional question. But there is a substantial point. If you're changing the composition of the Senate, even shortening their tenure, is this just another matter, like making them retire at 75, or is it changing the nature of the Senate? So maybe Janet could say something on that. But the other thing is everyone, Mr. Harper clearly knows that introducing, trying to generate constitutional reform, which would be required for direct election of the Senate, is just not on. So this cunning plan is a very, is an obtuse way of trying to create, nominally to create that situation. I should say, perhaps this was the second point, the missing second point, that if Mr. Harper was around long enough and if senators started to appear in substantial numbers who were elected at these provincial or Senate nominee elections, then the dynamics of the Senate would change hugely and everybody would be upset. The national government would be upset. The provinces would be upset. The provincial governments would be upset. So there would be, it would generate, or could generate, a coalition required to make substantial constitutional change, reduce the powers of the Senate, and maybe do other things as well. But one, I don't believe that's Mr. Harper's intent. And two, it would take a very long time, even if Mr. Harper is in there for, well, unless there's plague or something. It would take a long time for that to occur.
Also, I misspoke. The Meech Lake Amendment formula would have had unanimous requirement for a Senate amendment. I think it's actually 7 and 10, which means 7 of 10 provinces with 50% of the population. It makes no difference. Ontario and Quebec oppose Senate reform, and you need one of them for the 50% population requirement. We will not be reforming the Senate through constitutional means anytime soon.
Unless, I mean, the other alternative is... if you remember the winners and losers, Ontario is clearly a loser in the Senate. Quebec is marginally loser, but okay, the Maritimes are big losers if you went for some a change, particularly to the weighting. Actually, there's another caveat too. Those ratios that are entrenched to do with senators are also entrenched the minimum representation of the provinces in the House of Commons, in the lower house. So trying to fiddle with the regional balance would be very complicated. But the thing is, it could be that if half of Ontario's... if every other province had elected senators and Quebec and Ontario were left not having provincial elections, then there'd be a fair amount of pressure, I would assume, for them to start going in that direction. But this is fancy. This is fun, but...
Most Canadians prefer abolishment as the option for reform.
Question from John.
John, you, this is a question that was prompted by Megan Ricardo's panel, but it's... something that hasn't come up yet, and it's an interesting one. We're talking about relations between two houses. One of the ways in which they work together or work in conflict is the presence or lack of presence of ministers in the upper house. I'm prompted to think about that because one of the issues that's raised here in Australia is a potential Senate reform to strengthen its capacity to act as a house of review in the minds of some is to take away ministers from the Senate. I actually oppose that. I think it's actually constructive to have ministers in the Senate, partly as a hostage, so that the Senate actually has something to aim at, but also to bring some experience to the people when they're out of government. Just wondering about the Canadian situation, but also British and Italian situation, particularly the Europeans, whether there's a strong or small presence of government ministers in the Senate, whether that matters. It should matter. I'm just wondering how it matters.
In Canada, we do it when the party isn't particularly successful in a region. So, I mean, Harper had to swallow his reform objectives of, you know, elected senators by appointing, and that did not go unnoticed in the press, appointing somebody from Quebec because Quebecers didn't, or from Montreal, didn't otherwise support him. The Trudeau government, who had trouble getting people elected west of Winnipeg, often had to do that. So there is a practice in Canada of appointing regional ministers in the cabinet, if you, or in the Senate, into cabinet if you don't have the representation. But it doesn't do, I don't think, much to change the legitimacy problems of the Senate.
Yes.
Victor Isaacs. Three unrelated questions, but they do all relate to the Senate, Canadian Senate. Firstly, in Canada, the House of Commons is telecast. The Senate is not. Is this because the Senate is afraid that if they were telecast, they would be seen to be irrelevant? Secondly, it is surprising that one of the elements of Mr. Harper's reforms was not to increase representation of the Western provinces to bring them more into line with population, especially given his Western background. Why was that? And thirdly, I just seek a comment on the theory that one reason why the Senate in Canada is not reformed is because if you do any substantial reform in Canada, it has the potential of reawakening the Quebec separatist question.
TV, I assume that's a punishment. I assume that the House of Commons doesn't want the Senate televised.
Well, although your rationale, the Commons shouldn't have itself televised because, it doesn't exactly show well.
But. No. The region is, Mr. Harper can't change the regional composition for any of the provinces in the Senate without constitutional reform, so that's locked. He has, though, made suggestions about changing the regional representation a little bit in the lower house, but he's done it in a way...
Angered Ontario.
Yes, and I still don't know whether that's just mean or is it part of a cunning plan? But what he's done is increased the representation of the Western provinces who were underrepresented, but has not increased the representation of Ontario, which was also underrepresented. I should say he doesn't have as many seats in Ontario as he does in the Western provinces.
If I can just add one issue on Quebec. I mean, one of the fatal difficulties with reforming the Senate along the way, the provinces... the Western provinces would like equal representation. Quebec vehemently rejects the idea it's one of 10 provinces. And so it's never going to accept equality. I mean, Ontario doesn't accept it for overrepresentation issues for the West or for the East, really. But Quebec will simply never accept that it's simply one of 10 provinces. And so Senate reform will... I mean, the criticism for previous constitutional failures on Senate reform is that they didn't tie it to something Quebec wanted. Because as a one-off, you're never going to get Quebec on side. And you had to perhaps marry it with something so that Quebec would have to stomach it with something that Quebec wanted. But we're past those days.
Roxanne.
Roxanne Missingham, Parliamentary Librarian. You've given us a very interesting description of the pressures and the community discussion on Senate reform now, and talked about the election, which may well lead to another government in power. Do you get a sense that there would be a different discourse and a different set of thoughts about Senate reform if Harper isn't the Prime Minister after next Tuesday?
My guess is yes. It's been a Western concern. I mean, one of the things with Harper is he seemed to be very, very tactical, strategic, cunning plan sort of guy. Well, that's really unfair because in some ways his cunning plans have worked. But the Liberals have much less motivation to try to change things. They have their other problems. And so I think if Mr. Dion is Prime Minister, which I think is unlikely, yes? But we never know.
Absolutely unlikely, yeah. Unfortunately.
Okay. The Senate will drop like a stone, as I think it will for Mr. Harper's agenda. I mean, there are other things to think about at the moment, and I think Senate reform will drop back to its place where it's been for 1867. I have a lovely quote in a thing which I took from a book on reform of the House of Lords from Crossman. You remember, Meg, that Crossman quote? Something like, on warm summer afternoons, you know, after dinner, you've got a glass of wine, people talk about reform of the Lords.
I think that's... There's not much else to do. Yeah, exactly, exactly.
The two large parties, the Liberals and Conservatives, really don't have an interest, a genuine interest in Senate reform. I mean, one of the problems for Harper is that he cannot form a majority without getting either serious representation in Ontario or and or Quebec. And he's really hoping for Quebec. Ontario is getting harder and harder for him. And they don't want Senate reform. And Liberals, which are considered the governing party because they're traditionally they're more likely to form a majority, they're served well by what effectively works as a unicameral system with a House of Patronage that they can reward and control. So I just don't see really much capacity of the two principal parties to reform the Senate. I mean, Harper earlier had been playing to his Western base, but he risks alienating his chances for a national majority by playing that up too strongly because he's just not going to be able to sell it in Ontario and Quebec.
I should say there is one thing I didn't mention, and that's another possibility. In British Columbia, there's the Premier is called Gordon Campbell, and he won an election in 2001. And after being defeated at an election where he got a majority of votes but not a majority of seats, he then won an election where he had all the seats in the chamber except two. So he had a massive majority. He then set about introducing or setting up the British Columbia Citizens Assembly on electoral reform to make specific changes to change the electoral system and by implication the structure of the parliament to make it more, make it fairer. This was against the overwhelming wishes of his caucus. This was his idea. So there's always the wild card, unlikely but possible, that a prime minister will come in who starts appointing opposition members to the Senate because maybe he's been exposed to Meg Russell. But this is possible, and the more I think about it, it may be the only way that reform is going to occur because of the pivotal position that the Prime Minister plays in the structure of the Senate.
Yet two smaller parties will not likely accept appointments, so it'll really be between, you know, maybe the Liberals or Conservatives can appoint each other and or maybe we'll see the Greens. But I can't imagine the Bloc accepting a Senate appointment and the NDP will not. So
I'd raise the pay. Double it, triple it.
It's principle.
Yeah.
Stan.
Very interesting stuff. I think I hear you both saying that significant reform is unlikely. And Janet, you said that the predominant opinion would favor abolition. What's the prospect of that? And is the status quo so damaging to anyone that they'd be willing to invest the political capital and the time necessary to try to promote abolition?
I don't think so. I mean, when Campbell was finishing with the scenarios of, you know, possible things to change, and his scenario was unpopular legislation that didn't violate the charter. Well, what if there was really popular legislation consistent with the charter and a Senate vetoing it? Perhaps that might provide some initiative. But as I say, I think the two principal large parties have an interest in keeping the Senate dysfunctional because it doesn't generally cause them difficulty and it's a great source of patronage. I think if you ask Canadians, most Canadians will, you know, often say well, either reform or more likely abolish. But there are still going to be some defenders of the Senate because the Senate does do good scrutiny work. And I mean, maybe it's the quote Ricardo had, you know, you know it when you see it, but you can't really define now what they're doing well. I don't see a strong move in Canada to abolish it. I mean, it's just...
Constitutionally.
And frankly, when John invites us back in 25 years for a reunion of this conference, we're probably going to be in much the same situation we are now?
Well, here's why. I think Canadians look to the charter as the check, not... I mean, they have so little confidence in either House of Parliament. And they're quite comforted by just taking politics out of taking it out of the political realm and going to courts if they have difficulties. And so I don't see a strong appetite for abolishing it. If you were asked, you know, which was your preferred reform, that's what Canadians will say. But I don't, can't see any political party taking up seriously the idea, or any political party gaining power taking up the idea of abolishing the Senate.
Thank you.
I'd like to comment on something, interesting terminological difference between the term of the use of the term redundant, which Tony used and other people have used. Now, I assume that Tony used it in the public choice sense, that is, redundancy, not as a waste of time, but as a way of providing alternative channels for solving problems. Just as, for example, these chairs have a lot of redundancy in them, in the sense that you could probably sit maybe four or five people on the chair before it collapsed. Okay, now that extra strength in the chair is redundant, but on the other hand, it provides safety. I should say that's why flying is dangerous. There's very little redundancy in a plane. Okay, wing falls off. Okay, right. But
there's only one left.
But redundancy is used in common usage and has been used here, meaning a waste of time, duplicating something which is not, which is just useless. And one of the interesting things about this concept is that, and what Meg has said and what other people with strong upper houses have said, is that the redundancy in a bicameral legislature provides flexibility and alternative routes to do things in a way which is not available in a single legislature. And what's sad about the Canadian system is the structure is there to provide that useful redundancy. But it only operates in maybe 5 or 10% of the activities of the Senate. Things like its committee inquiries, its checking of legislation, da 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 da. So the irony is that if the Senate were more redundant, in Tony's sense, it would be a much more useful institution.
I can add, I think one of the most promising reforms that we could ever do is just have more joint committees. I mean, some of the most important work we've ever had was on constitutional assessments. And this was joint committees looking at proposed charters. I mean, if we could have more use of joint committees for things that, you know, the really big events, that, I think, would help legitimize the Senate. But we don't do an awful lot of joint committee work.
Okay. Oh, Meg? I was about to explain the choice that we have before us, but you ask a question.
We've got lots of time.
Officially, it's at 3, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, I know, but okay. I was going to set out a choice.
The luxury of these discussion times we have now. Something else occurred to me following Stanley's question, a question, but also a tiny point. What happens if Harper's bill doesn't go through and he continues to not appoint? Is there a risk of a death by a thousand cuts in that the Senate just gets smaller and smaller and less effective and less legitimate, and in the end grinds to a halt? Or will the Liberals just come in and say, great, we can appoint 40 people and let's do it? And my tiny point is on the small party point. I thought that was an interesting point, again with resonance in the UK, that there are some parties that won't accept seats. We used to have parties that wouldn't accept seats, and it's taken some years, but the parties are now competing, the small parties, to get in there. The Welsh Nationalists used to be opposed to the House of Lords, but they now see, the small parties are seeing, it is the place to be to influence legislation. And they changed their policy, and they've now elected some people, a bit like the people for Alberta, and are saying, it's time Prime Minister appoint our people. What about the Plaid Cymru people? We elected them. So it can change by degree.
Keep in mind, the Bloc is a separatist party that's not going to accept the legitimacy of national institutions other than, I mean, there's an irony, of course, it's in the House of Commons and it has been official opposition. I think it would be pretty hard for the Bloc to accept appointments to the Senate, and the NDP has generally a policy position, and their former leader has been offered a seat and just refused. So, I mean, their position is to abolish the Senate. So that leaves the Greens, and they have to maybe you could have one or two Greens elected or chosen to the Senate, but I just don't see the smaller parties as currently constituted accepting any Senate appointment. Now, maybe the answer then is independence. And no, I mean, people are talking about that. What if governments were just to start appointing non-partisan, you know, the wise people? That might be a better avenue for reforming the Senate, perhaps. Then you could get Canadians to accept that appointment alone is not inevitably the sign of illegitimacy. It's the partisan appointment that's the problem. So that might be, you know, I mean, I think if a prime minister were smart, he or she would set up a panel of let's come up with some really good names of wise people that we would want in this sober second thought venue. I think that is probably the much better avenue, because then you would sort of overcome the problems of the party discipline and the whole patronage aspect. But nobody's talking about that, as far as I know.
There is pressure from some provinces value their senators more than others, and it's clear that the maritime provinces do, partly because they get benefit from over-representation. And I think if a sufficient number of the... if Mr. Harper's returned and there are no more appointments, and a significant number of the maritime senators shake off this mortal coil or whatever, then I think there'll be... Now there are just mumblings or grumblings, but I think there would be real pressure from a variety of sources to say, look... we've got to have some formal consultation. You'll note that Saskatchewan and Manitoba have said that they were in favour of citizen consultation. So I know the Mr. Harper's Act says it has to be an election run by STV, but it could be that some colourable form of consultation, maybe short of STV election, might be accepted by Harper as a way of generating... senators. I say, but the whole thing is, I don't really think he wants to do it. I think it's just one of those things.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, this talk of there'd have to be some kind of political cataclysm for change to occur. I'm thinking of the Australian upper houses, and Campbell, you know them as well as I do, where positive reforms were carried out, reforms we would approve of, pro-democratic, improving the deliberative process, etc. The public wouldn't know anything about it. They'd know nothing about it. And it seems to me that a positive reform takes place virtually exclusively when the elites get into a quarrel and stalemate. As Dankwart Rustov says, when the elites polarise, and what we hear from you here is that in Canada there is no polarisation on this issue.
No, I think that's true. I think that the other thing is that some of the Australian upper house reforms were driven, and of course you can change things, there's much more ambit change by ordinary legislation rather than constitutional change. Many of these changes were driven by, and we've already dealt with it, a realisation by the Labour Party that it was better to have an upper house which could be awkward to the non-Labour parties. First of all, abolition wasn't going to fly. And secondly, it was better to have an upper house that could be as awkward to non-Labour as Labour parties as to have one that was only awkward to Labour parties. So there was kind of tactical advantage. And the trouble in the Canadian system is that the payoffs for Senate reform are either contradictory or highly dispersed, contradictory, almost randomly distributed, so that there's no single strategy that appears obvious to anyone to generate the support for constitutional change.
Also, Canadians have a good appetite for non-democratic venues. I mean, the most popular institution is the court and the charter. They don't seem to be particularly troubled by kind of democratic deficits. So,
and we reject MMP. You know, so we have first past the post, and we have appointed senators. And
Harvard, British Columbians voted 58% for STV. Yeah. I've in this thing I was involved in, we travelled around British Columbia, or not just me, but various other people, and there was wide acceptance that there was need for electoral reform and constitutional parliamentary legitimacy. Great enthusiasm for the parliamentary system, but feeling the current thing had fallen down. So there again, and
CBC. We were 34% for more straightforward MMP.
Yes, but MMP is the poor person's proportional representation. I mean, I'm sure it's only been...
And New Brunswick rejected it.